Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This is episode 2 in our series on the destruction of the chemical weapons at the Bluegrass Army Depot pilot plant in Madison County. In this episode, we'll focus on the employees of the pilot plant as Shepard Snyder takes you on an audio tour of the chemical destruction facility and Crystal Jones meets the people who made sure the destruction of the weapons went smoothly. Their experience in their words. We begin with Shepard Snyder and a bit of theater of the mind, if you will, as we take you on a tour inside the facility and follow the process of destruction at the chemical weapons pilot plant. A quick note, you can find Jean Marie Hibbard's photographs of the tour on our website, esweku.org.
Bluegrass Chemical Stockpile Outreach Office is unassuming. It's the project's front face to the public at large, where I meet the rest of the team and our tour guides. Sarah Marco, Outreach Coordinator, and Mark York, Communications Manager for BechtelParsons Bluegrass. They have us on an airtight all-day itinerary. The outreach office is decorated with educational displays of rockets and protective suits, once taped at the cuffs and inflated. Standing behind a podium in the corner of what's otherwise an aggressively normal room where we gather at a conference table to be briefed on our tour of the pilot plant. Before we actually head to the depot, we're required to watch a video briefing going over safety regulations. We're given a safety vest and a small army green messenger bag containing a gas mask and a syringe filled with a neutralizing agent, in case we're somehow exposed to any toxic chemicals, however unlikely that might happen. The video we watch contains instructions on how to administer the agent, alongside a lot of other safety rules that are much more mundane in comparison. It sounds more dystopian than it actually is. It's standard procedure for anyone visiting the depot, regardless of how close anyone actually gets to any chemicals.
This is a short video presentation to provide you with information about our mission and to orient you to ensure that your visit is both safe and informative.
The briefing ends and we board a nondescript white passenger van. It's a 10-minute drive from the outreach office to the main facility. The whole experience feels pretty heavy. Not depressingly heavy, just heavy as in what we're about to see feels like a pretty big deal, like there's an unseen weight to everything. We pass through clearance gates, all which have someone on duty. After the last gate, we park in a main courtyard, workers paying us no mind as they move from building to building. Sarah is explaining some of what we're seeing along the way that includes storage igloos, earth-covered bunkers that used to store non-chemical weapons that line the road to our first destination.
In front of us are the igloos where the weapons used to be stored. We're using some of those igloos now to store the containerized rocket warheads that have been drained of chemical agent until they can go to one of the two static detonation chambers.
Can I grab a seatbelt on?
Once inside, we park in a main courtyard and exit the van onto a safety sidewalk indicated by blue paint, winding like the spaces on a board game between buildings. Workers pay us no mind as they move in colorful vests and jumpsuits along the blocks.
Can I trouble you to let me in the con, please?
The first stop on the tour is called the Control and Support Building. It looks like something from the set of Apollo 13. Workstations, people in headsets, small lights glowing on consoles, and huge monitors in the center show mechanical arms and other contraptions in rooms elsewhere in the plant, all used for weapons disposal. Here we meet with Michael Kester, the shift plant manager. The monitors in the center of the room are displaying other areas around the plant in explosive containment rooms. There, automated machines do most of the work processing and disposing of the weapons.
So the console here, more towards the south, is actually done the lion's share of the rocket processing operations. Control room operators from there, they monitored all rocket movement, munition movement, and agent processing.
As we talk to Kester, he shows us each control panel and what in the pilot plant it operates.
All the other consoles control the rest of the facility activities. So right here we have people entering into a toxic area where they're in a hermetically sealed DPE suit in order to enter that toxic area safely. And that alone presents a lot of challenges. And I kind of think of it akin to really astronauts performing a spacewalk, if you will.
Other consoles control air filters that detect the concentration levels of airborne chemicals inside any given room, so they can make sure agents aren't going where they're not supposed to be. Another controls the HVAC system. If there's any air leakage, it controls the airflow and vents it to more contaminated areas before any air goes through the facility's exhaust stacks. Another staff member is monitoring the breathing air getting pumped into workers' full body suits when they must enter a contaminated area. More on that in a bit. Now, the focus is towards getting rid of the residual chemicals. The main mission of the Chemical Weapon Disposal Project itself is finished, but surrounding objects that may also be contaminated also need to be made safe.
Although all the munitions have been punched and drained and free of chemical agent, there's still a lot of chemical, not a lot of chemical agent, but there's still residual chemical agent and contamination inside the building. The building's contaminated. So we have to go through the process of decontaminating the building and the facility and ensuring that it's reduced to a safe level so we can ultimately dismantle the building and turn it back over to the Army.
We move into the next room. This room houses equipment, suits, masks, and tanks of air. The center of this room is a large monitor where two people inside air-filled suits are delicately moving about inside a remote space. Their movements are slow and deliberate. They appear weightless at times. The suits have hoses connected to them that run somewhere off-screen, and similar hoses are draped around large wheels on the wall, much like you'd hang your garden hose on. The room smells like rubber. Big marshmallow white full-body jumpsuits are hanging limply, prepared for whenever they're going to be used. They cover the body from head to toe with a transparent plastic opening for the face that resembles the window on an astronaut helmet. Mark York.
When they go from one room to another, and they're on hoses, so there's a way that they'll connect and then disconnect to go into another room. So hose management's kind of a big deal. I don't know if you ever tried to, you know, pull a 50 or 75 foot garden hose through your backyard without tripping over it or, you know, getting tangled up in some outdoor furniture. So you can imagine wearing one of those fully encapsulated suits, you know, pulling a 75 foot hose.
The actual disposal process happens using automation. The goal is to have the least amount of human contact with any contaminated object as possible. But when there's necessary maintenance or cleanup duties to be done, flesh and blood workers put on these suits and go through an entry process for any room with heavy levels of agent. Right now, as operations at the plant begin to wind down, real-life workers are needed to go into the rooms and spaces where weapons are stored to clean them up. It's part of the chemical destruction plant's preparations of these spaces for future use. Mike Kester.
We have people here in the control room. They're monitoring all the plant systems to ensure that their safety is not compromised. We're monitoring them on CCTV. We're in constant communication with them. We also have paramedics that are in constant communication with them. Because any inconvenience in there is really magnified by how big of a deal is it really? Because of the level of contamination that's in some of the rooms here, we don't want to spread that out to unprotected workers. So there's a lot of focus on ensuring that the work that they perform is safe and deliberate, and we're really safe and deliberate entering and exiting the toxic areas.
They're hooked up to long white plastic tubes that trail behind them. That fills the suits with clean air they can breathe while they perform their duties in spaces that are otherwise contaminated. We take a minute to look at what it is they're doing, staring at the black and white feet of the two spacemen, maneuvering around pipes and their own air tubes. I'm using the astronaut comparison a lot, but watching the feet itself, it really does look like a window into another world.
Yeah. Dave, if you go to step here in a minute, there's a big ball of hose right behind you on your right side, so watch out for that.
We file into a small break room. To our left is a guy in a baseball cap and a t-shirt, his elbows on his knees and his hands clasped before him. He seems pretty calm as everyone shifts quickly around him, an attribute which undoubtedly serves him well in his position.
Okay, so my name is Carl Reagan.
Carl is the operations support manager.
And the department that I manage as part of it is the DPE support area. DPE stands for Demilitarization Protective Ensemble. really long word. That's why we use DPE. So my folks take care of inspecting the suits, the backpack, the radios that they wear inside that you heard them talking on. We take care of all the equipment they wear inside the suit, to include their suit itself. We inspect it prior to them getting dressed. We dress them by a procedure. It's the same way every time. We do double cross checks to make sure all the critical things are within their suit, have been turned on, they're adjusted correctly, and combo's working, their bottle's turned on, all those critical things before we zip them up that final time.
In the room with us is Dana Mendoza, the demilitarization support area operator. She's actively involved in prepping the gear.
We get here in the morning and we try to prepare everything for the day's events. We're not sure, you know, how many entries we have, but we try to get our radios all set up. That's my job. I'm head honcho, we'll say, of the radios. I'm pretty stickler about, you know, keeping my radios.
Detail-oriented.
Yes. Whenever we find out who is going in, we pull paperwork. We then go pull their gear. Their gear being whatever size suit they wear, their pack with the special size of mask that they wear, anything special that they may want. Some people like what we call a cooling vest. It kind of helps pull the heat away. Some like an ice vest, which keeps them cool while they're in there, because there's times that these guys work so hard in their suits that they could lose 2, 3, 4 pounds while they are inside the suit. So it's a lot of water weight that they're losing, but still, we're trying our best to keep them as cool and as comfortable as we can in the suit.
Carl Reagan.
Something happens to them that they can't make it back to the airlock on their own ability, then we stand ready to go. Emergency response time is expected to be 1 minute. We're on air, zipped up, and in the room, putting them in a stretcher, dragging them back to the airlock, and doing an emergency cutout to pass them across to the clean airlock to awaiting medical personnel. So our medical personnel are also on standby.
But that's a worst-case scenario. Before workers can go out into the field to do cleanup work, they have to go through some pretty in-depth medical inspections, making sure they're in shape and are physically able to perform the work.
Our folks that actually go into those, they get a really in-depth physical once a year, and then every time before they go in, they have to go to our clinic here on site.
The process of getting workers prepped for entry happens multiple times a day. Of course, that also means going through another process after the work is finished. Dana Mendoza.
So whenever an entry is done, we get the gear that they have taken off, we bring it back, everything is washed, looked over, inspected, and then they have to put a bond on a machine, which we calibrate, make sure everything is working in proper use, and then get it set ready for the next entry.
Our conversations with Carl and Dana marked the end of our time at the Control and Support Building. We left the building and got back into the van to our next destination, making our way through the plant's courtyard. We pull up to what looks like an airplane hangar. It's a big cylindrical dome with a massive entryway, large enough to easily have a truckload in. Harvey Riggins, maintenance supervisor.
We've designed for these rockets, mines, ton containers, projectiles, anything that's contaminated. These things have some rigorous tests done. I think they was built in Mexico, if I'm not mistaken. And they've been around for about over 25 years, I believe. So they're pretty old. And so, but they had a lot of tests done on them to verify that they would handle an explosion.
Harvey Riggins leads a crew of operators who work out of the container handling building where we are now and the designated unpacking area. Once we're shown around the hangar, he shows us how the enhanced on-site container opens and closes.
My ER crew right here, these two guys here, it's about three or four of us actually. So they'll be conducting opening procedure. And so listen to them, and they'll make sure that you're going to be safe, you know, while you're performing this operation.
Ready?
Going for an open. Single open indication.
Once they are load it, they close them up, they do a test on them, make sure it's not leaking or anything like that before they bring them on site. And that way to make sure everybody's safe here.
The way it's set up, it kind of makes you want to like it, sit inside it. Right. I know I shouldn't.
At the edge, yeah. Baby.
For something as mundane as watching a door opening and closing, it's about as cool as it gets. In the distance, as we are moving to the next area of interest, is one of the buildings where the containerized GB rocket warheads are processed, the Static Detonation Chamber 2000. Closer to us is a clean air exhaust stack. It's massive, probably about 10 stories high. It looks like a metal pipe sticking out of the ground, surrounded by metal fencing and a staircase snaking up to the top. Sarah Marco.
Those ducts are pulling all of the contaminated air out of the building. They're going through these carbon filters, and then they're released. The air is released from here, but there's air monitoring throughout the entire process so that they know chemical agent is not being released into the atmosphere.
As we continue along, Mark points out one of the carbon filter banks.
So that's silver building that you see right there. That's one of the filter banks. They're about the size of a school bus. And each one of those contain a series of filter banks. There's a pre-filter, there's a HEPA filter, and a series of carbon filters just to make sure we're filtering out. Should there be any agent coming out of the building, it all gets filtered before it comes out and released to the exhaust stack. But again, it's continuously monitored throughout the entire process.
Our next stop is the medical facility. The building it's housed in looks pretty standard. A walkway leads up to a ranch-style, one-story building with an awning overhead for shade. There's an ambulance parked to the side of it. To the right of the facility, a similar building is labeled as restricted, except for international inspectors, U.S. escorts, and authorized personnel. That's the Office for International Inspectors. The creation of that office being the result of an international treaty banning the use and production of chemical weapons. It includes more than 190 sovereign states. The destruction of the weapons inside this pilot plant is overseen by inspectors from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, based out of The Hague. As we head inside the medical facility, a loudspeaker announcement interrupts our train of thought and seems to read our minds.
Attention all site personnel. Heat stress controls are now required due to outdoor temperatures. Perform outdoor work cycles of 45 minutes of work, 15 minutes of rest per hour. Attention all site personnel. Heat stress controls are now required due to outdoor temperatures. Perform outdoor work cycles of 45 minutes of work, 15 minutes of rest per hour.
Walking outside in the middle of July on one of the hottest summers on record, wearing slacks and a button-up shirt below my required safety vest, a knapsack dangling from my shoulder filled with emergency safety equipment, it's not the most comfortable thing in the world. Thankfully, we're back inside for the time being. Here we meet with Dr. Craig Tokowitz, the medical director at the plant.
Hi, Tokowitz. Shepard Snyder.
Hi, Crystal Jones.
Nice to meet you.
Jean Marie Hibbert.
Hi.
Nice we're with you. WEKU.
Okay. All right. Do you guys know Ira Glass?
No.
Yeah.
You do?
No.
Oh, you're messing with me.
He talks to us about the main function of the medical center. It's a full-service medical department, but it's specially outfitted to take care of its workers in case there's an exposure. On the far side of the room, behind a work desk and a computer monitor, there's a window that allows us a glance into a room that's otherwise off-limits. From our point of view, I can see shower hoses hanging from the ceiling, medical diagrams taped to the wall, and all sorts of assorted equipment. That's the decontamination room, which workers exposed to any chemicals enter through a separate door from the facility's main entrance.
But if somebody's exposed, then we draw their blood and we compare it. And if there is a, you know, if there's a significant change with those levels, then that is involved in our decision-making in terms of determining whether, in fact, there was an exposure to nerve agent, and also in terms of when a person can go back to work, because then we monitor those levels and wait for them to come back up. You know, the other things, too, is that we have, you know, household stuff like pesticides and herbicides and stuff like that that may affect those levels, certain disease states, mm-hmm. so we have to be aware of that when we do it. If somebody's really sick and they're acutely exposed, mm-hmm. then we treat them with medications like atropine and midazolam, which is for seizures. So if they're really sick, they need to have their airway protected. So we do airway, we breathe for them.
Thankfully, Tokowitz says exposures don't really happen. All this is procedure for the worst case scenario, but it doesn't stop the medical facility from keeping busy.
We're busy with drills. We're very active with drills, and that's kind of the drills are, they're disruptive in a good way. So it kind of breaks our routine and gets people used to, you know, dropping everything and doing what we need to do. But we really haven't had any exposures, which is that's something I've been here for over 7 years. And you just kind of in the back of your mind, you're like, okay, we're doing all this training. I don't want to ever have to use it.
And aside from exposures, workers also need to be examined to make sure they're staying fit. They'll also come to the facility for any work-related injury or from something that's even more common, heat stress. Monitoring for heat stress is one of the primary jobs for paramedics on site, like lead paramedic Aaron Stamper.
With heat stress, we're worried about how much weight that the entrants lose from sweat inside the inside their DPE suits. The other thing we're worried about is, you know, dehydration, increase in heart rates, blood pressure, being fit for duty, those type things. So every time that we do an entry into a chemical area, we have a medic that is assigned to those two guys that are going in, or those two entrants that are going in. So the medic's only focus is their health and well-being.
We head to the personnel support building for a quick lunch. We only have one more scheduled stop, but this one's a doozy. We're close enough to our next destination that we can walk instead of taking the van. Most of the chemical weapons at the pilot plant are destroyed using neutralization, but some of the more problematic munitions were disposed of using a static detonation chamber, a safer alternative to incineration. It uses thermal decomposition in an airtight chamber to destroy the chemical agent, recycling the leftover scrap metal. And even though all the weapons themselves have been destroyed, the two SDCs still need to remain on site through 2024 to destroy all the residual chemical agent. More than 65,000 canisters considered secondary waste are still set to be destroyed through that period of time. The SDC 1200 will destroy more than 17,000 containerized rocket warheads containing residual amounts of VX nerve agent. The SDC 2000 is currently destroying the containerized rocket warheads containing residual amounts of GB nerve agent. There are around 48,800 of those containers left to destroy, but that number is getting smaller every day. We meet up with Rusty Davis, deputy plant manager for the Static Detonation Chamber 1200.
When we're ready to bring a skid of canisters over, we'll open up the service magazine, and then we'll bring it over to our main building over here. And then this is where you're going to have to go that normally you can't go.
We pass through a hallway at the front of the building where workers are resting, and we enter the room where the chamber resides. It's a beast, large enough that staircases and metal catwalks are installed so workers can easily maneuver around it. It's about three levels high. To an outsider, it's impossible to tell which part in the room does what. It's a jumble of steel with pipes stretching everywhere, connecting machine parts of all shapes and sizes. But Rusty goes through the most important structures for us, including their role in the process. We start at the ground floor, where an area is sectioned off by glass walls and blue metal rods joining them together. On the other side of the wall is a huge mechanical arm that handles the drained rocket warheads, starting the first stage of the detonation chamber's process.
This robot will come and pick those canisters up, and they'll take them to... See these saddles right here? They'll put two of them right there. Okay? And then from there, this machine will make a box. And this box will create the box that will pick those two canisters up and put inside the box. And the box, you'll see a box sitting right there right now.
A literal box.
A literal box. It's just a cardboard box. They'll take this and make it into a square box.
And then from there, there's a robot that's on top of here. We'll pick those two canisters up and put them in the box, close the box up, staple it, and then from there, we can start our process. We'll fill up our conveyor line, and then we can start the process.
Once the robot puts the boxes full of warheads on a conveyor belt, they're moved to the top of the detonation chamber. Rusty moves us up the stairs to look at the next part in the process.
So that box will get on a feed conveyor that's all the way down, and it'll ride this elevator all the way to the top. And then from here, it'll go into what we call an airlock or a chamber. And then from there, it goes into our first kind of our destruction process. And the box will be fed in here. And inside here are hydraulic cylinders. And you see these hydraulic cylinders here? And inside there's a cradle. And basically that cradle, once we're ready to feed, that cradle rotates and the box gravity drops down to the detonation chamber downstairs.
That's where the magic happens, the chamber where high heat detonates munitions and any chemical agents are destroyed. We walked back downstairs one level to take a look at it.
So this is the detonation chamber. And really it's two pieces. You have an upper half and you have a lower half. And if you think about it, it's like you got two clamshells. And we lock it in place and we pin it in place. And then it allows us to go do your destruction process. Typically, when we're running about 1,000 degrees, within about 15 to 20 minutes, you'll hear the destruction process.
The detonation chamber is made of really thick steel, thick enough that Rusty actually invites us to put our hands on it while it's running at 500 degrees. It feels only slightly warm to the touch, sort of like putting your hand on a heating pad. Once the agent is destroyed inside the chamber, the residual scrap metal is dumped to a box below.
Once we fill it, we can put so many containers in there, and then we got to get rid of those containers. So roughly, I'm going to say 36 to 40 canisters, we'll be ready to do a dump sequence. And basically, we'll unpin it, we'll rotate the upper half, and then we'll lower this whole detonation chamber, and then it rotates and just dumps.
All told, the entire process takes about 2 to 3 hours to get through a whole box of munitions. That includes about 45 minutes to load the conveyor belt. The leftover scrap metal that gets dumped goes into a rectangular metal box, kind of like a miniature dumpster. It's labeled "Contents may be hot" in Army stencil. That's not totally the end of processing, though. The gases that are generated still need to be caught and taken care of. That's where the off-gas treatment system comes in. Rusty takes us to another room where another big machine called a thermal oxidizer is housed. That cleans up the gas before it goes out the clean air exhaust stack we saw earlier.
So from here, we're operating at 2,000 degrees. We just can't go stick 2,000 degrees out the stack. So we need to start cooling things down.
From there, the air is sent through a processing tower that cools it from 2,000 degrees to somewhere less than 200 degrees. The air is also scrubbed even further as it continues through the tower.
Yeah, we have our destruction process where the SDC's at. I said if there's anything residual, the thermal oxidizer will kill off. And then if for some reason it goes through the entire scrubbing process, it'll come through this carbon filter bay. So this is another added feature to protect any gases that's coming through before it goes out the stack.
Of course, this entire process needs to be observed. There are so many moving parts, so many steps involved, that there needs to be a bird's eye view to watch the whole thing. Not only are agent levels monitored through the entire cleaning process, but a small building nearby houses a control room where workers keep an eye on every corner of the detonation chamber through security cameras. In the center of the control room, a bright red emergency hotline is sandwiched between monitors and wires, in case anything at the SDC facility malfunctions.
These are, very important jobs because they're the eyes and ears of the plant. They're seeing what's going on in the plant. Everywhere we walked, pretty much everywhere we walked, they were able to see where we went. So the DynaSafe equipment that you saw here today, we've got teams from overseas that are here helping us do the commissioning work. They're kind of the SMEs. We've got programmers. We've got SME subject matter experts that come over, help us get things brought up to speed, tuning. Because all this was built overseas,
okay.
Assembled,
initial test it, and then we ship it overseas, bring it overseas, bring it here, and then we assemble everything.
The off-gas treatment system is a German design, so that comes from Germany. The SDC, the static detonation chamber, is coming from Sweden.
The control room includes international programmers and engineers intimately familiar with how everything works. As Rusty continues explaining the control room and operators' jobs to us, the workers are laser-focused on their duties, watching the wall full of monitors intently and barely noticing us. And even though all the weapons themselves have been destroyed, the SDC still needs to remain on-site through 2024 to destroy all the residual chemicals.
It's about a year for us down here, because you've got the residual. Those rounds are 99% drained. But you've got that residual you need to go get rid of. You just can't go throw those away. So that's why we're here, to go get rid of that residual.
We walk back to the personnel support building as we end our tour. Walking past these offices in the support building reminds me that the folks who work here are regular people. The plant has just been the setting of their daily life, and we've been granted the rare opportunity of a small window into it. I'm Shepard Snyder, reporting from the Bluegrass Army Depot.
Coming up after the break, Crystal Jones speaks with employees at the chemical destruction operation. I'm Tom Martin. You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events from Kentucky Humanities. On Thursday, September 7th, the Kenton County Public Library in Covington will host Speakers Bureau, My Dirty Life, presented by Doris Settles. This program will begin at 6 p.m. On Saturday, September 9th, Chautauqua Days of Millersburg will host Kentucky Chautauqua, Aunt Molly Jackson, Pistol Pack and Woman. The show will begin at 11 a.m. at the Millersburg Town Square Park. Also on Saturday, September 9th at Chautauqua Days of Millersburg, catch Kentucky Chautauqua, Roscoe Tarleton Goose, Kentucky Derby winner. This program will begin at 2 p.m. at the Millersburg Town Square Park. And on Tuesday, September 12th, Kentucky Humanities will host the fourth and final installment of their disaster recovery webinars, sponsored by the National Endowment for the Humanities. This program will begin at 10 a.m. via Zoom. Registration and more information can be found at kyhumanities.org. I'm Sherry Lawson, now back to Eastern Standard.
Welcome back to Eastern Standard. I'm Crystal Jones. The maintenance and later the destruction of the chemical weapons is not just the story of the last rocket. We will hear in this segment from the employees in their own words what it takes to work in such a serious environment and what their plans are when the job is completed. We begin at the beginning with what it takes to become an employee in the program with Michael Kester, shift plant manager, as he explained some of the requirements to work with chemical agents like the ones being destroyed here at the plant.
What's called a CPRP, or the Chemical Personnel Reliability Program. There's a lot of vetting that goes on to the personnel before they're authorized access to chemical surety material.
Throughout the tour, as we spoke with each employee, we heard about the jobs and the day-to-day duties here at the plant. As we continued our interviews, employees revealed that this was not simply a job, as in a task to be completed. It has become substantially more than that for those who have taken part in this journey, bringing people from across the country to work here in Madison County.
Originally from Dallas, born and raised.
In Arkansas.
In Newport, Indiana.
I'm actually originally from Texas.
Originally, I'm from Ohio.
And for many here, seeing the last chemical weapon destroyed has been a career-long endeavor.
20 years ago, I was a new hire in Newport, Indiana, where we processed chemical agent VX.
Yep. Very first one back on Johnston Atoll out in the Pacific. Very first chem demil facility that they built.
30 years ago.
I moved here, we'll say, 23 years ago.
I spent 4 years in Tooele, Utah, and then I spent 16 in Alabama.
I've been doing demil for 21 years.
I actually started in the demil program. I was a sergeant in the Army. I got a year hardship tour. I got stationed on a small man-made government island called Johnston Island back in 1998.
The seriousness of such a job over so many years, one that, as you could imagine, you can't exactly discuss over dinner with the family, would create the need to connect with others who could understand the mindset required to perform these jobs. The employees not only share the work, but the mental workload, and have bonded over the decades of moving from site to site. Rusty Davis, Deputy Plant Manager.
As a brand new con operator destroying chemical weapons, I left Tooele, and now we're back working together again. And it's like now we're like, we started the program when we were young, and now we're ending the program back together again.
Stephen Bobbin, Plant Safety Leader.
Absolutely. Especially for me personally, being a shift worker for so many years, when you work these swing shifts and nights and days, you get a closer bond than even just a 9-to-5 day shift job. You know, everybody comes in. You still do, but it just makes that you're a team.
The closeness among employees contributes to an environment that is crucial to maintaining focus and building trust in a workspace that demands both to achieve its goals. Raquel Lowndes, Senior Safety Specialist.
One of my things that I like to do when I'm out on site is talking to the employees, asking about their families and that sort of thing. So I think that actually builds a bond.
Not only would this atmosphere make them closer, it would give them an opportunity to set examples for those who would follow in their footsteps. Dana Mendoza.
Really not a big number of women that are in the DSA. That me and one other female are the only two DSA operators. There's just two of us now that are in this position.
The commitment to their jobs and their ability to work together under pressure allowed them to continue with their initiatives even through the pandemic years. As the world outside came to a halt, the chemical weapons destruction plant continued to work toward its ultimate goal. Michael Kester, Shift Plant Manager.
So COVID and the pandemic presented a number of challenges for us here in the control room, but our workforce was able to abide by all of the protocols that were put into place and maintain rocket processing and also projectile processing during the height of the pandemic, which is frankly remarkable that we were able to accomplish what we've accomplished, not only with a pandemic, but we accomplished everything ahead of schedule to meet our international obligations, and we did so safely and compliantly with all the environmental requirements also.
Mark York.
We finished four munition campaigns during COVID. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're 24/7. We didn't stop. And that's a testament. You know, you mentioned the safety. And our workforce just did an incredible job every day during COVID to be able to come in and keep themselves safe and healthy away from work to be able to come here and still perform at the high level that they needed to perform. They just did an outstanding job.
Post-pandemic, things returned to normal at the pilot plant, and this meant that the end of the program would soon be approaching. And for the workers, it was all coming into focus. As we spoke to the employees, both a sense of passion and pride was evident in their retelling of their experiences. Michael Kester, Shift Plant Manager.
Well, let's go back a little bit. And we work a 28-day rotation here on the DuPont schedule. So as we started the rotation, on a set of night shift. I was kind of looking at our processing rate and the stockpile inventory that was remaining, and I told everyone our shift, we're going to complete the campaign during this rotation. So we need to put a lot of focus on staying focused, making sure that no one is looking past the end zone, no one is looking past the next one that we punch and drain. We need to put a lot of focus on being here right now throughout the entire rotation. As we got more near the last one, we realized that it was going to be during that set of day shifts. When we came in during that set of day shifts, we said it's going to be Friday or Saturday that we process the last one. When we got to Friday, we knew that was going to be the day. Friday morning, I want to say we had around 100 or so to process that day in order to close it all out. So we kind of done a brief pause here in the control room, had everyone step back away from their consoles, and we really focused the energy on making sure that we do everything correctly, making sure everything's by the book, making sure all the personnel are focused on the right thing. So I was on shift the day we processed the last rocket. I stood next to our control room operators as they brought it in, as they punched it, and as they cut it and punched it and drained it. And leading up, in the days leading up to it, I didn't really think much about it. The last rocket is just like any other rocket. But as the last rocket came in and we were processing it, that's when it really dawned on me.
Carl Reagan.
20 years ago and 10 years ago and maybe 5 years ago, I couldn't really visualize that in my head that there would never be any more to get rid of. But now that's the case, though.
Autumn Rogers, Unpack Area Operator.
I was on the floor. We waved a goodbye to it as they took it in on the conveyor. Didn't really think about it till we got to the last rocket, but I'm from Madison County. It's something that has been brought up to us all through my childhood, and always having the meetings about what's out here, you know, being warned about it, what to do if something happens. And it's just, to know that they're gone now is a good feeling. It's kind of gets a worry off your chest a little bit.
Fellow Madison Countyans are feeling the relief too, at least the relief of knowing the weapons are gone. But as the chemical agent pilot plant gradually closes, one question has been on a lot of minds. Stephen Bobbin, plant safety lead.
To be on the very first site almost 25 years ago, to watch this end now, I just helped work myself out of a career. You know, what do I do next?
Mark York.
We're in closure now, and you're asking about, you know, for our personnel here, workforce, what does that mean? Well, we need the vast majority of our workforce to stay here throughout closure, because you saw the closed circuit video of the entrance. Those people who've been maintaining the equipment, doing the entries at, you know, for waste management activities, we still need those same people to do more entries throughout the closure period. So you will not see like an immediate drawdown of personnel here from our project. It's going to be a slow drawdown. It's going to be a couple of years before you see any significant reduction in our workforce. So I know just kind of everybody thought, oh, last rocket got processed, that means they're shutting down. No, we still have 2 to 3 years of work left, and we need the vast majority of our workforce to stay here.
According to Mark York, employees will be released from their jobs as the need for their positions change. Workers were given notice as to when their jobs would be complete. For some, the end of this project signifies the end of a career.
And do you kind of have an idea of where you'd like to go from here? Have you
besides retirement?
I'm old. I'm ready to retire. So timing of my job change and everything has worked out well. So
we're retiring on this chemical demill side and retiring in life as well.
For others, retirement might not be in the cards just yet. So where do such highly skilled persons find work after the chemical agent destruction plant comes to a complete close? Carl Reagan.
We're starting out, that's what we call our total workforce planning initiative. Yeah. And so certainly, you know, I've been in this position before myself, but I typically had, you know, my choice of which other demill facility do I want to go to, and now the workers here don't have that. So certainly for them, you know, we've been making, you know, quite a few different programs to, you know, contact other businesses, other facilities that may be existing or are coming on board from some of our joint venture companies. You know, we have, you know, facilities all over the United States and all over the world. And, you know, we certainly try to, there will be a move to, you know, if you worked here, the type of facilities that certainly government, you know, top support facilities, you know, you would be a prime candidate to get hired at one of those.
Dana Mendoza.
We're coming to the end. It's kind of surreal. This is it. It's going to be done. You know, what do we do next? Like Carl said, you know, there's plenty of avenues that we can go down that, you know, there'll be jobs that will be available, whether we want to stay here or we want to, you know, leave the state and go somewhere else.
The hope among many Madison County leaders is that there won't be a need to leave. Peter Healy now heads the Mountain Association, but was among the earliest to take action in 1984 when it was learned that the Army had initially planned to incinerate the chemical weapons.
For people that want to stay, I think there are always going to be a lot of options here. And if we look at where the growth opportunities are, we see a lot of opportunities that are technical jobs in the energy transition. For example, with all of the new federal supports for clean energy, whether that's energy efficiency, high-end HVAC systems, or solar or wind, there are jobs that there's going to be an enormous demand, particularly because of the tax incentives and other federal programs that are supporting that transition, that are going to create technical opportunities for people. And some of these can have a very relatively short turnaround time in terms of training for those jobs.
And Hilly says early on, it was clear how important this workforce was to the community and the world.
One of the things that we realized early on was that this was a fight, but it was not a fight between us and the folks at the depot, that we shared the really important common interest of safely disposing of these weapons, and that the safety of the community, the safety of those workers was always paramount for all of us. And over the course of time, we built relationships there. Those relationships were often extremely valuable in helping us to get up-to-date and accurate information to the policymakers in Congress and elsewhere. So I just want to express my appreciation to the folks that have done this work over these decades and celebrate the fact that here we are at the end of something that seemed like it went on forever. And I've thought many times in recent weeks of Jerry Garcia's line about what a long, strange trip it's been.
Dr. Candace Coyle has served as the site project manager for the Bluegrass Chemical Agent Destruction Pilot Plant.
The real heroes of the narrative here has been the workforce. I was fortunate enough to play a very small role in the legacy that's going to be this historic mission that the U.S. has just completed. I often say that it was the right place, the right time, but this was the right team the entire time. And I think that's the one thing that I've learned, is that this team has always been the team to get it done. There's never been a way where ego has gotten in the way. We have a lot of partners, and we all work together. We had one team, one mission mentality. You know, from the state regulators, from KDEP to, you know, local officials, to the community itself, Craig Williams, you know, Reagan Taylor, everybody that's been a part of that. KDEP, looking at Bluegrass Army Depot and looking at the Bluegrass chemical activity, of course, we could not have done it without any of these folks. So I think that's the one thing I've learned, is that this level of teamwork that was required to get this mission done was not an insignificant factor, but we had all the right people here the entire time. And I think that made my job a lot easier than it could have been.
It was an unforgettable experience for me to simply tour the pilot plant and to meet what I would consider real-life heroes. It's a rare glimpse into the lives of everyday people who have accomplished the extraordinary. The work these individuals have done will impact the world, and their stories will be part of history. These people have risked potential harm every day to make the world and Madison County a safer place. That moment on July 7th, when the last rocket was destroyed, would be captured in hundreds of photos and dozens of press releases. But we journalists could never explain it better than the people who'd lived it.
It was definitely emotional. There's a lot of that, you know. We really did it. I've been on a few of these, and this was by far the most challenging process with the changes and the COVID and all the additional challenges we had. So it was definitely, felt great to achieve it.
I'm really proud of this accomplishment, you know, seeing it started out from the beginning and seeing it through to the end. And it's been a very challenging but also a very rewarding career for the last 30 years for me personally.
Oh, I'm feeling great about it. I relocated here for that purpose.
You know what? It's probably a sense of pride and just a lot of work, and you know, people were safe, and you know, we got through it without incident. And I mean, that was the biggest thing.
Michael Kester, plant manager.
So how do you follow that up?
That's the million-dollar question.
What now? Yeah.
That's right. No one knows what the future holds. So we've got a little bit of time here to decontaminate this facility and close this facility out. So the world will be a different place here as we work through that process, and we'll just see what doors open.
Very special thanks to our guides, Sarah Marco and Mark York,
and to Michael Kester, Carl Reagan, Dana Mendoza, Harvey Riggins, Autumn Rogers, Dr. Craig Tokowitz, Aaron Stamper, Rusty Davis, Raquel Lowndes, Stephen Bobbins, and all the employees at the Chemical Agent Pilot Plant. This is Crystal Jones reporting from the Bluegrass Army Depot.
Join us next week for part three of our series. We'll focus on what an end to the chemical weapons disposal project means to the economies of Madison County and surrounding communities. You'll hear from David Stipes of the Richmond Industrial Development Corporation, David Duttlinger with the Bluegrass Area Development District, and Madison County Judge Executive Reagan Taylor.
And I think the things that we're going to look for when we're talking about recruiting industry is we're going to look for industries that are complementary of the workforce that we do have at the Bluegrass Army Depot. Those jobs will be going away. It's approximately 1,400 jobs. Not all those 1,400 jobs will be replaced because some of the surveys they've done out at that workforce is some of those folks will be retiring. Some of those folks will be moving on to another location somewhere else. But there's a tremendous amount that want to stay here. And so for those that want to stay here, I think we have to support their experience and what their background is in and try to be able to recruit industry here that'll be complementary to them.
Beyond the future, for those who have been part of the work to destroy chemical weapons, the closure has a ripple effect on the many businesses that have supplied the project. Joining us will be Eastern Kentucky University Supply Chain Management Professor James Kirby Easterly.
There's the work that's going on out at the depot with the destruction of those chemicals. But there's lots of other companies that, you know, have employees that are providing services, everything from security personnel to maintenance team, food and beverage providers, uniform providers, truck drivers. All of those things I like to think of, you know, in an economics context of, you know, it's a multiplier effect for every employee that is on site working towards the destruction of these chemicals. There's lots of other people working for other companies that, you know, have a part of that too, albeit indirectly.
This and much more of the story of how the economy of Madison and surrounding counties is affected as chemical weapons disposal operations at the Bluegrass Army Depot winds down to a close by 2027. Thanks for joining us, and many thanks to Crystal Jones and Shepard Snyder for reporting, writing, and co-hosting this edition of our series. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Jean Marie Hibbard, senior producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org and weku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.